Angela Jackson. I'm the Vice Chair for Education for the Department. For those of you who don't know me, I know most of you. This workshop is going to involve some actual work, and you're going to need a partner. So if at some point you're still sitting by yourself at a table, do not be shy about sitting down with someone else. Introduce yourself. And we are going to need some work. There's a pack of papers upside down on the table. Don't turn it over. You'll get to that point shortly. Let's start with a case. Now, as I've described walking through the case, feel free to adapt it depending on your own particular teaching situation. Maybe it's a classroom instead of bedside. Maybe the age of the patient is 102 instead of 22. But so feel free to adapt this to best meet your kind of where you're at with your learners. So the case. Your intern admitted a patient with pneumonia, symptoms of heroin withdrawal. She did a very cursory workup, did not treat the patient's withdrawal symptoms at all. When you question her, she says, what's the point? She's just going to leave AMA anyway. I don't have time for this. So you point out the importance of managing withdrawal symptoms in an acutely ill patient, and you offer to review the management of heroin withdrawal with her. Your intern rolls her eyes. So whether it's in the classroom or whether it's at the bedside, your intern is not particularly excited about what you have to say. So what's the diagnosis? That's what we want to focus on today. Not so much the diagnosis of the patient, but the diagnosis of the learner. What we're going to talk about is the reluctant learner. So what do I mean by reluctance? That's the first thing we're going to do. We're going to define reluctance. We're going to learn how to diagnose the reluctant learner and why it's important to do that. And then in the small groups, we're going to discuss effective approaches to engage this reluctant learner. So this is my definition. The reluctant learner is a learner who appears not to be eager, willing, and ready to learn what you want to teach. Has anyone encountered such reluctant learners? Yes? Never. So next time I want to be on your service. So remember this definition, somebody who doesn't appear to be eager, willing, and ready to learn what you want to teach. So give me some examples of reluctant learners. And why are they so memorable? Yes, do I have to know this for the test? Do I have to know this for the test? No, but you might need to know it someday if you actually want to take care of patients.
They're going into something that, like orthopedics, you know,
not relevant to me, I don't care. What else? Texting. The texters. Yes.
They just want to get out of there. They're just desperate to leave.
Yes.
I already know it, and I don't need to know what you know.
So, usually we spend a lot of time at this part because it tends to be kind of this therapeutic, cathartic session where everybody wants to kind of tell their favorite story of the reluctance that they encounter. This is a list that's been put together over my own personal experience as a teacher, then hearing from other teachers, the know-it-all, the minimizer, the passive-aggressive, the labeler, and some of the examples that you all brought up now. But why are they so memorable? Why is it when you say reluctant learners, like, yes, been there, the eye roller from the case, even though maybe that exact clinical case is not the scenario that you've encountered, it tends to resonate with teachers that, yeah, been there before. Why is it that it's so memorable, and why do you know that you're, or how do you know that you're in face of a reluctant learner? Think back to the definition. Yeah.
Makes you a reluctant teacher.
Makes you a reluctant teacher, yeah. You want to bump them over the head with a 2x4 or shake them.
There's no obvious way to correct an attitude, an attitudinal issue.
So it makes you feel like it's hopeless. And if you're teaching them something, the expectation is that you think that it's important for patient care or for science or for whatever reason. You think it's important enough to teach. And so that barrier, that them not being quite willing to take what you have to say, is very frustrating. There's this gut sense of, grr. And when you're teaching somebody and you feel that gut sense of, or I want to reach over and just smack them upside the head, be sure that you're in the face of a reluctant learner. So we're going to spend some time talking about what to do in that. So why the reluctance? That's the first order of business. Why the reluctance? So I want you to humor me for a second and think back to your own medical school and residency days. And I want you to imagine the most boring, the deadliest of all attending rounds. Okay? Are you there? the most horrific, just completely irrelevant, oh my God, may my beeper go off now because I just want to write a colex order for someone. That kind of get me out of here moment. Okay? You all there? You remember a deadly teaching moment? Perhaps this is a deadly teaching moment. Now, do you really think that your attending on that day woke up, leaped out of bed, and said, today, I am going to give the most irrelevant and the deadliest attending round in the history of humanity? Probably not. The fact that that's what they did, at least in your estimation, is irrelevant, but that was not the intention of the teacher. So perhaps, could it be that we were all at one point reluctant learners? If the definition is not ready and willing to learn what I have to teach, you sitting there in that attending rounds were defined by your attending as a reluctant learner. Yet look where you all are today. Accomplished physicians and teachers. So the first step is, and if you want to fall asleep after this, you can. This is the key point. Reluctance is not a permanent personality trait, but a modifiable state. And if you can remember this, there is not a reluctant learner that will ever be able to get the best of you. Our tendency when faced with a reluctant learner is to dismiss as disinterested, doesn't want to know, doesn't care, unprofessional, and just dismiss and move on. Partly because what we're trying to convey, we care so deeply about because it has to do with patient care and excellence in patient care. So if they're not willing to listen to us, we label them as bad, useless, hopeless, forget it. If you remember, though, that you too were a reluctant learner, you can step back and perhaps start thinking about this learner in a different light. So it's a modifiable state. And it's your job, and actually this is the fun part, to figure out how to act, interact with that state and move into someplace else. So approach the reluctant learner as you would a clinical case. The same consistent approach to clinical medicine or to science that you have in your career outside of the teaching role, those are the same concepts that you can apply in your teaching role. So in clinical medicine, the first thing that we talk about is to make a diagnosis and take a history. Everybody has their acronym. I have mine, ASK. So in order to diagnose the learner, you want to make sure it's ASK. Is it a problem with attitude? Is the resident or student judgmental? Are they just bleeding heart? They can't set limits. Is it an issue that they lack skill? They can't put their knowledge into practical use. There's this disconnect. Is it that they're uncomfortable asking the questions? Do they lack knowledge? They don't understand the clinical relevance of the material. They don't understand what happens when a patient leaves ANA in terms of the mortality rate. They're missing some background information. That scaffolding, that basic scaffolding on which to hang new medical information, if that's missing, you're not necessarily going to have them jump up and kiss you if you're trying to teach them something new. So, when you think about this, Dave Batnelli used to show this all the time, some of you might remember. If you think about the learning process, it all occurs here. There's the context on the wards, in the clinic, in the classroom. There's the teacher interacting with the learner, interacting with the content. This is how learning occurs. And this is where you're going to diagnose the reluctant learner as to where the problem is. So when we talk about the ASK, it's attitude, skills, and knowledge of the learner. Because clearly, if the learner is a reluctant learner, the problem is theirs, right? Yes?
Not always.
Not always. Remember, you were sitting in that deadly attending rounds thinking, please, I'd rather see Pinsko have than be here. Was it your problem, or was it something else? So this is find the lesion for medical educators. When I was in medical school, we did find the lesion for neurology, symptoms, signs, and then you kind of work through and figure out where it was. This is find the lesion for educators. So, for example, the observed behavior from your learner is that learner appears to be not to be interested. I want to go into something else, and who cares about this? Well, could it possibly be a problem with the teacher? Too long-winded, not clear on the relevance in this particular clinical setting or this scenario. The learner, post-call, had they just reviewed it with the chief resident, and the chief resident was much more interesting than I was when I should have been explaining? Are they distracted? Is there a sick patient? Is it just distracted with life and some other things that are going on? Is it the content? Is the clinical relevance of what you're trying to explain not clear to them? Or is their background knowledge missing? The same way, the know-it-all the one that really gets under my skin knows the answer to everything. And quotes the articles really fast, so you're not quite sure what they said. They just went, New England Journal in 1962. Well, is it the learner or is it the teacher that's intimidating and kind of makes them want to one-up you or kind of step up to the challenge and present themselves as the know-it-all? As a teacher too tentative. So they're really doubting that you in fact master the material. Does the learner in fact master your material? No, it's good. Thank you. Thanks. Does the learner in fact already know it? Are they truly the know-it-all because they do know this? You're trying to teach them the basic P, Q, R, S, T wave, and they were EMTs for 10 years before coming to medical school. They got that covered. Are they afraid to admit deficiency? And the content, is it too basic? Or again, is the importance not made clear? So when you're faced with a reluctant learner, that kind of systematic working through problems that we do with patients in terms of coming to a diagnosis, you can use also with the learner. Don't assume it's just them, but look for the lesion in that learning context, the learning triangle that we just talked about. Step two, the therapeutic trial. So how many of you have treated a patient with, comes in with pneumonia, febrile? Yeah? And you put them on antibiotics, and the next day you come in and they're still febrile. What do you do? Well, sir, I'm sorry, but clearly I'm going to have to discharge you because you're not interested in getting better. No. What do? You wait a little bit longer. You stick with the same antibiotics. Maybe you adjust your therapeutic regimen a little bit as you get new information that maybe you tap the empyema. But we don't give up with one try. Yet with the reluctant learner, that's exactly what we often do. You roll your eyes at me once and I'm done with you. One of the things to think about is that this is a chronic problem, such as some of our medical problems, and it might take more than one try. A patient who comes into the office with an A1C, my personal high, of 24, no, I'm not proud of it, but there it is, my expectation is not that the patient come back to see me with an A1C of 7. My expectation is, or my goal, is that they come back to see me. The same thing with the reluctant learner. It usually takes more than one try. Keep the focus on the behavior that you're trying to change and keep your goal realistic. If you only are going to work with this individual once, you're not necessarily going to get them from the eye rolling to the eureka moment. So keep your goals realistic. Now, the therapeutic trial. There are some treatment options, and I want to, for the lack of an all-day session, I'm just going to talk to you about one little package of skills for you to have in your back pocket. But you're all very clinically savvy. You've been teaching, savvy teachers, and I'm sure you have your own approaches and your own skills, and there'll be time to practice that in a second, but I'm just going to give you one suggestion, an outline, or a framework to use when addressing the reluctant learner. Has anybody used motivational interviewing with patients? Heard of motivational interviewing? Develop discrepancy, avoid argumentation, roll with resistance, express empathy, support self-efficacy. Is this familiar with anyone? Mm-hmm. Yeah? A couple of nods and a couple new things. All right, well, motivational interviewing, otherwise known shorthand as MI, can also be called principles of MI. Because these same steps are effective with the reluctant learner. So, for example, develop discrepancy. If you think about it, very few of our learners are true psychopaths. Are few. We won't go there. Most of them are well-intentioned people who decided to do medicine to help humanity, and their goal is to learn the material so they can be good doctors or scientists to take care of the patients to make them better. So one very powerful tool as an educator in face of this reluctance is to show them the discrepancy between their intentions and the observed effect. You intended, I know that your intention was to help Mr. Jones, blah, 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 but when you walked out of the room, threw your beeper at the nurse and told her to hurry up and hang the antibiotics, just for an extreme example, you could point out the discrepancy, their intentions, their behavior. And that's extremely helpful for the learner to kind of step back and understand how their good intentions might be perceived by others. So that's something to keep in your back pocket, to be the mirror for your learner to kind of have reflected in your feedback to them that kind of discrepancy. Avoid argumentation, that goes without saying, right? Student comes out of the room, you were rude to that patient, no I wasn't, yes you were, no I wasn't, yes you were, no I wasn't, yes you were. It's going nowhere. So don't even go there. There's this thing called rolling with resistance. And this I had more trouble putting my mind around, but it's the most fun. So rolling with resistance means instead of when faced with something that is disagreeable, incorrect, instead of going right at it, you work around, change the focus of the conversation until you can come at it from a different perspective. For example, resident walks out of the room where a 78-year-old patient was admitted and just in a huge huff talking about waste of my time. This patient's just going to die anyway. This is the fourth time they've been admitted this month, cardiomyopathy. He's just going to die. Why are they wasting my time? Why is he here? My reaction might be to call him on it. Like, who the hell died and made you king to decide who comes to the hospital or not? Would get me nowhere, and we would start immediately with this kind of conversation about how inappropriate the behavior was and his job as a doctor, non-judgmental, blah, blah, blah. So how about if this is the dialogue? Resident flies out of the room. He's just going to die anyway. Is he? Is he what? Is he going to die? Well, he's 78. Yeah, I agree with you. Let's talk. And so you start talking about the mortality associated with an EF of 5. Pretty soon, you've engaged them in an actual productive conversation, and you can agree. Instead of smacking him upside the head for being such a jerk, you're actually agreeing that the prognosis is poor for this patient. And as you talk and discuss and bring him around, now you're talking about goals of care and how better to care for the patient. And yes, you agree that bringing this guy into the hospital 4 times in a month may not be the best use of his remaining time. And you kind of roll with resistance and come back around, and now you've engaged with your learner and you're actually teaching him something. Does that make sense? Express empathy. Being able to understand where your learner's coming from is important, but don't confuse that with agreeing. Something is wrong is wrong. Inappropriate behavior is inappropriate, but yet you can still express that you empathize or you understand where they're coming from, but that doesn't mean that you have to condone the behavior. And the supporting self-efficacy is making sure that whatever plan you come up with is something that your learner can actually do, and encouraging them and their how would you manage this differently moment, rather than prescribing next time you do X, do blah, blah, blah. So encouraging them to come up with what things they might want to do differently and how you could help them with that step. And step 3, just like in medicine, if it gets complicated and you don't know what to do, get a consult. Talk to other colleagues. Chances are that somebody who really pushes your buttons and you want to shake every time you see them doesn't bother Henry me nearly as much. So I might come to Henry and say, hey, what would you do with this guy? Or I'll swap teams with you, anything, $50, take the kid. Talking to colleagues, it can be a very helpful way of figuring out what to do with a challenging case or a challenging learner. Talk to the program director, talk to the clerkship director, especially if your interaction with student or resident is a tiny aliquot in their training period. No one expects you to do it all, but to not bring it up means that the problem is discovered de novo every single time, and there isn't a continuity or a way to effectively piece by piece chip away at some of that reluctance. So that's a framework of how to approach the reluctant learner. The main point being, reluctance is not a personality trait, it's a modifiable state. Anybody can teach the eager, bushy-eyed, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, whatever it's called, student, right? They're going to learn on their own. They can learn with or without you. It's that eye roller or the know-it-all. Those are the folks that need you. That's the challenge, and that's the fun part of being an educator. So now we're going to have a chance to get to the fun part. At each of your tables, there's a packet, which you can turn over now. And on the packet, there is a case. And take it away.
Okay. So everybody has a different case, and it sort of goes through all the different cases of learners we identified.
I'm sorry, at the beginning.
Sorry, I'm Rachel Stark. I'm new to the faculty as of this summer. I'm in the section of general internal medicine, and I'm the assistant director of the primary care training program. So I work with Angela, and here I am jumping right into sort of my first BMC faculty presentation. So on everybody's table is a packet with all the different types of reluctant learners that we sort of discussed early on in the presentation, and with a specific sort of juicy case to kind of get you thinking about that type of learner. if the one that's on the top is the one that's on the top is sort of the meant to be the one that's sort of assigned to you, but if that one is just one you can't think about or don't want to think about, or your group decides just can't wrap your mind around it and you want to do a different case in the packet, we've provided you with all of the possible cases and you're free to choose. And what we'd like you to do is, with your group, read about the case, this particular learner, and what is problematic about just sort of the summarized interaction, and then brainstorm together about what are the possible diagnoses of this learner, and then maybe possible treatments. What are things that you could do or things that could be changed to kind of get this reluctant learner from being reluctant to perhaps being more interested? So is that clear? And then we're going to sort of talk about everybody kind of a different case, and then we'll come together and talk about all the different cases that everyone discussed. Questions? Nope. Okay.
So remember, if know-it-all is the problem, that's the behavior that you're observing. You want to figure out why. Why are they coming across as the know-it-all? Remember that grid of your, it's the find the lesion moment, and then...
Right. So what's the diagnosis? Is it, you know, the teacher? Is it the learner? Is it the content? Is it, what are all the possibilities? And then what might be things that you could do to address those possibilities? This part of the exercise is fun because it leads to a lot of catharsis, whether you think about the sort of patient or reluctant learner that you were assigned, or one that you can remember that has given you particular displeasure in your role as a teacher. So I just want to go to each of the different groups and sort of talk about the cases that each of you were presented with, and maybe sort of brainstorm as a group about what are sort of the possible diagnoses, and then what you all came up with as treatment options. And if there were people in a different group who want to add to what the working group has come up with, please feel free. So this is sort of an open discussion. So I'm going to start with this table. So who is your reluctant learner?
Know-it-all.
Know-it-all. And just, can you just quickly read the case? So those that...
Yeah, you're rounding with your ward team and talking about the use of antiplatelet agents. Of course, the medical student interrupts two or three times during the conversation to quote articles, quote-unquote, published a few months ago in the New England Journal, but seems to have his facts just a little bit off each time. He's been on the team for a week, and the same thing seems to happen, both during work rounds and teaching sessions.
So do we know this know-it-all learner? This kind of comes up in some sort of, something maybe very similar, but it happens all the time, the interrupting medical student, the person who always needs to quote the article, but somehow it's just a little off. And I know we did talk about this a little bit in Angela's sort of introduction, but what kind of things did you come up with as possible diagnoses for the know-it-all?
So our group came up with, Dr. Kinsley, I came up with the leading diagnosis, insecure with their knowledge base.
Okay.
So I'm going to go through the diagnosis, Angela, and then can we go through the prescriptions? Okay, so then, lack of attention to self-gender. What else do you call this stuff? Yeah, they're doing the work and not getting recognized for it. So there's not enough, that they don't feel they're getting enough attention or recognition from the team. I don't know how you want to phrase that.
Needs recognition? Needs to feel loved?
Yeah.
Needs.
And the third diagnosis we came up with is that the information is just, for them, too basic. Maybe they did, you know, cardiovascular research for 10 years prior to going to medical school. Maybe they were one of the authors on the article. That's happened to me. A lot of ways. Oh, yeah, I wrote that article. Like, oh, really?
And did you ask if you were sure they were quoting it correctly?
No, I don't ask that because I don't know. I don't know the details, so I don't want to.
Okay.
Okay.
Did anybody else from the group who maybe didn't do the know-it-all, any other sort of ideas about what might be the underlying issue with the know-it-all that wasn't covered?
We discussed the same case, mm-hmm. And we agree the first diagnosis was insecurity or incomplete knowledge. And the other one that prominently figured in our discussion was Asperger's syndrome of high functioning autism. This is a possible diagnosis to be considered. And as far as the treatment aspects,
I think we
go.
So, what was the last one?
Asperger's syndrome or high functioning autism.
Yep. And I'm sorry, was there another
the treatment
one?
Was what we discussed afterwards.
Okay.
We thought we would let you speak first.
Any other thoughts that people have about the know-it-all?
Thoughts that you would like to share that in professional company? Maybe I guess the information too basic. I was just thinking frustrated with the teaching.
they want to go to a higher level, but that's your feedback up.
Perhaps it's not even the learner at all. Maybe it's this interaction with the teacher. Maybe they think the teacher is wrong. Or maybe they're bored with the teacher. So the teacher can sort of, we always want to blame the learner, but going back to that triangle, because we're perfect, going back to that triangle, sometimes it's the problem with the teacher or the delivery of
the
information.
In this situation, in the war team, is that there's multiple learners and teachers, and oftentimes the learner and the teacher are the same individual, like the interns and the resident. Because I've had similar situations happen where the resident's acting as a teacher, but the intern thinks that the resident is an idiot. And the intern, so, you know, then there's all this kind of stuff going on, because the resident will say something, and then the interns think that they're wrong, and so then they correct them, and it was. So these are challenging situations, because the
Absolutely.
Teacher is often the learner.
And there's a lot of competing priorities in the learning.
Who's standing around the chart card.
Sure.
So I'm going to call it team dynamic also plays a role in that. Mm-hmm. If you're trying to show up the resident, or you're just trying to supplement what the resident isn't giving. Although there's the data quoted wasn't correct, though.
But the learner thinks it's too basic.
Right. That's the right perception.
Sure.
Maybe the student or the learner wants to get an A or something, so figures it out by quoting journals.
They're hyper-focused.
It's quote a journal in Swedish or something, so no one will know that they're wrong.
Maybe yours is wrong.
It's always Google
Translate.
So being very focused on one self-promotion, right? So that's a big thing sometimes with medical students, depending on what time of year it is and what their interests are and who the attending is and who's writing letters of recommendation. And the same is true for residents and fellowship, you know, applications and what service you're on and all of those types of things. So great. So getting back to the diagnoses and trying to match what are the possible options to those things, what did you guys come up with when you were thinking about the possible diagnoses?
I think we thought for the one of needs recognition, right? So what we would have the student do is say, okay, this is a great opportunity. Why don't you help the team out, pull the article, and then go through and summarize the article, you know, your final 5-minute mini presentation on rounds tomorrow. That way you don't call them out that, you know, what planet are you from? That's not what the article says, but you give them an opportunity to show the real information without calling them out for.
And I think in some ways that sort of analyst strategy about the role with resistance, you're not necessarily overtly sort of getting into a debate with them about you're right, you're wrong, you know, who's right about the interpretation of the study. It's sort of giving them the opportunity to say, okay, well, this is a point of discussion, bring us the article, we'll all sit around and we'll talk about it, and then perhaps everybody will learn in that scenario, and perhaps the teacher in this case needs to learn something too. So that's great.
So you be willing to be flexible and give some of your role as teacher away and let them do it.
Well, yeah, of course, my gosh.
Other thoughts about either what to do about needing more recognition or insecurity or other issues that came up? Did the team in the back come up with anything to combat insecurity?
You know, we thought first thing is to identify the problem. Once you've identified the problem, to find a way of conveying it to the resident. And then one other thing we thought was that somebody would be insecure because probably they have partial knowledge but not complete knowledge. So then discussing around the topic and all aspects of the problem would be an important thing. And then, you know, if things don't work out, speak to them in private rather than speaking in public and saying, I'm criticizing them in public. Speak to them in private and saying, these are the aspects that we noticed in you. I just wanted to point this out to you so that you are aware.
Maybe even giving them a chance during that sort of private consultation. You know, what's going on with this? What, you know, I noticed X, Y, and Z. And, you know, you keep quoting all these articles, and we hear you. And what's up with that? You know, and maybe they're able to self-identify the insecurity, or maybe they're not. But it's sort of good to sort of take a step back, have your own differential diagnosis. Maybe you think it's insecurity. Maybe it's something else. Giving them the opportunity to sort of talk about where they're coming from, and perhaps you may be able to sort of see how much insight they have or don't have, and help coach them a little bit. But that's a great idea.
And along those same lines, you could try to check in and see if you're not meeting their own personal learning goals to find out if they really do think it is too basic.
Absolutely.
What their past is learning.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, were you a cardiologist in another country and now you have to do a residency here? Is it something, you know, were you, whatever it might be, that is sort of the scenario they've had prior experience and they didn't necessarily share that with the What about team dynamics? This is a hard one. Dan gets to walk out even though it was his
there
day.
There are RVUs to be harvested.
I think we need to check in with other different team members and find all the perspectives to find what's going on. I've been surprised by this at times. Like later in the month, I'm like, oh my gosh, this has been going on for weeks, and I'm just having a
mm-hmm.
And you know, only one person, if you're only one perspective, you don't see the whole picture.
I think also in the scenario of attending rounds, we only see a very small snippet of the day, right? So you're there for a couple hours during the day and you observe the team, but maybe there's something entirely different going on when they're not sort of on their best behavior, and maybe the resident is very pushy, or maybe people really need to feel like they need to stand up for themselves on rounds because they're not getting enough air time. You know, you don't know what other sort of team dynamics are happening. You only see sort of the small piece when you're there. So investigating what else is going on with the other members of the team, I think, is a really good idea.
And in that same vein, I think it's okay in a safe learning environment to point out what's right about a statement and also what's wrong,
mm-hmm.
and deflecting to the other members of the team to try to figure out how to correct the wrong part.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's part of the team dynamic, you know, showing that, you know, it's okay to be wrong, and also other people might have ideas too.
And sometimes it's a learning opportunity, right? So maybe all the trainees in the group, whether they're medical students or interns or residents, sort of have interpreted a study incorrectly. And maybe it's time to kind of sit down and take a step back and sort of let's go back to our EBM skills and think about really what did the folks in the study do. And I could understand why you would interpret it this way, but really this is what it is. Or maybe we can't, you know, extrapolate this data to our patient or this group of patients or whatever it might be. So sort of discussing that and letting the errors kind of rise to the top and having everybody have that open, I mean, medicine's dynamic. We do that all the time, even out of training, sort of have those debates. Whether one can screen for diabetes with an A1C or a fasting glucose. Sorry? Yeah. So this group over here, what did you guys have?
Minimizer.
Okay, can you tell us quickly about the minimizer?
So the case is basically you're on ward grounds, there's an admission, and the resident presents the case as here with non-cardiac chest pain, ready to go.
Are we familiar with this case? It happens a lot. The case is beneath us, nothing could possibly be wrong with the patient. So what did you come up with possible diagnoses for this learner?
Well, went from the learner and from the teacher. The learner that maybe had, case it says it was the third presentation. So maybe since he has to discharge this patient, there's a lot of work, and this is the third case, and so he has a lot of work, so he's trying and to minimize it so he can get back to work.
So overburdened and making choices for one's own survival, right?
Right.
Okay.
And then from the teacher's standpoint, that maybe the teacher was too long-winded on the other two cases, and so that's why he got to this third case that he did. And maybe, you know, these are work rounds, and then maybe some of the long teaching points he had in the first two cases could be for the teaching conference. And to realize that you have to get through three cases or how many cases.
Right. So misplaced teaching opportunities, maybe, and the teacher needs to be sensitive to the demands of the day and sort of the pace of the day and all that. Okay. Other thoughts?
Things to help with the first cases is to sort of make realize that, yeah, it was non-cardiac chest pain and saying how. But if you don't get at what the chest pain is, the patient's going to go home and be admitted the next time he's on call.
Right.
And so to go from that standpoint, yeah, maybe you can go home right there, but, you know, what is the other, you know, pain due to? Because, say, if it's due to GERD and you don't treat the GERD, he's going to come back and someone in the ER who was the missed patient, we're going to be there and admit him again. And he's going to go back. At this point now, they'll go back to the same team who's been submitted within a couple of days.
Right. So that's sort of your role with resistance moment, right? Like, okay, right, so maybe it's not cardiac chest pain, but maybe we have an obligation to figure out what the chest pain is so the cycle does not keep repeating. So you kind of roll with the, all right, I hear you. The person does not have ACS, and we don't need...
Appeal to enlightened self-interest.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, this will help in the long run.
That's great.
Mm-hmm. Point out the snapshot in the spectrum of life that they may not have linked and connected with. Oh, yeah, wait, how do I put this in a bigger context?
Okay. Any other thoughts about the minimizer?
Yeah. The last one we had, we really were struggling with the treatment, but it was the idea of respect, that if this, you know, is this person... homeless, drug user, is English as a first language versus, you know, would they have been treated the same way in terms of this presentation if they had been a lawyer from Back Bay? Just wondering. And so just thinking about how to address them. Actually, the case that we were talking about, we're talking about sickle cell patients.
Mm-hmm.
That's where there's like almost a culture that it's okay to talk about sicklers that way. And on how to address that.
One of the things that I also thought about when you mentioned the word respect, whose issue is it? Because there's the respect of the learner, not respect the patient, but if the learner doesn't feel respected by the teacher,
mm-hmm.
why the hell am I going to expound what I think is going on? You're going to do whatever you're going to do anyway. That kind of can make you step back and say, does he feel like he has a voice in the team, or he or she has a voice in the team? Do they feel disrespected, and that's why they're not really engaging?
And also to add to that, if the person feels disrespected by the patient, they may be much less likely to give them optimal care, right? If there's some sort of personality thing or...
The choice word I'm going to put on that table is dynamic. I like that euphemism, the dynamic.
Yeah, there's a dynamic relationship. So there's lots of things that kind of feed into these problematic educational situations. And I think, you know, there's not necessarily a fix to that, but perhaps just sitting around and thinking about what might be impacting the learner, and then perhaps you can address it with them openly in terms of issues of respect. That's one possible way of doing it. I'm not saying it's the best way, but...
One of the things to try is reflective listening that we do in primary care, trying to get people to change behaviors. Without asking a question, you just reflect back to the patient what you heard. You can do that with your learner. You can reflect back and kind of maybe even go out on a limb and say, make a statement around what you perceive. They can't disagree, it's not truth or untruth. I perceive that you might feel blah, 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 just to check in. And then they'll say, well, no, that's ridiculous. I'm dumb. Okay, good. I got it. And move off in another direction. Or, yeah, that's exactly what's going on. That patient was really rude to me, and so that kind of checking in with this is how I perceive this interaction went, just to throw it out there to see what you get back.
I think also like that respect thing is this downward spiral mm-hmm. that feeds off a tired student, a tired resident. And I think role modeling
mm-hmm.
and just bringing everyone back to the core of why we're here, like, yeah, it probably is non-cardiac chest pain, but what can we do to help this guy? Like, what can we do to actually help him? And because everyone's a good person, and they're just reminded why we're here.
And I think
you're
even
discrepancy.
Yeah.
Getting out of the spiral.
And I think role modeling, sometimes that you as the attending and seasoned physician actually may have a difficulty communicating with the patient and how you role model that for the team and how you handle it. So I don't think it's any secret that there are patients that we find difficult, and it's really easy to say, oh, the resident can't do it, but I think we all have that sort of internal thing happening sometimes, and sort of how do you name it in front of people, and then how do you actually model your interaction with a resident that is difficult, with a patient that's difficult for you to handle, and that's a really important lesson for a trainee.
So in the last 30 seconds, just the take-home points. Remember, reluctance is in the eye of the beholder. You too were once a reluctant learner, and look where you are today. The same systematic approach and the same skills that work in your other life or your clinical work also work with challenging or reluctant learners. And with that, I want to thank you for your attendance. Take a moment, please, and fill out the evaluation. And after you fill out this side of the evaluation, what I'd like you to do is turn it over and write down, because they actually on number three, before you turn it over, specifically, is there something that you learned today that you're going to try in your clinical, in your teaching? And then turn it over, and on a scale of zero, no way ever, and five, absolutely, how likely are you to try something new based on what we talked about today? Just one number on the back of the sheet.